The science of happiness is a hot field today, but it wasn't always like that. For a long time, researchers were preoccupied with finding out what's wrong with us, not what makes us thrive. Enter Richard Davidson. His work studying the effects of mindfulness using tools of neuroscience have made him one of the foremost experts in the world on the brain and well-being. Davidson's work collaborating with the Dalai Lama and studying the brains of Buddhist monks, expert meditators, helped him earn the title of one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Today, he's the director of the Wiseman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Veronica Rickert and I talked to Richard Davidson at a recent event in Madison.
We're going to start with a basic question. What is mindfulness?
Well, mindfulness has been defined in many different ways. And if you talk to a scholar from the contemplative traditions from which it's derived, they may have a very different sense of it than the sense that is often displayed in popular media and by modern psychologists. The way modern psychologists typically define mindfulness is paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally. That's a standard way in which it's defined. I was just very recently at a lunch a couple of weeks ago in New York City in honor of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. And His Holiness was there. And I came back and I said to one of my friends, I learned something about mindfulness and what it is from being with His Holiness. And what I came back and said is that mindfulness, for as exemplified in the demeanor of the Dalai Lama, is treating every single human being like they have the full potential to be a realized Buddha, to be a kind and compassionate being, to exemplify the most positive, extraordinary qualities that are available to us as human beings, treating every single human being that way every single moment of the time, and remembering that that is really at the core of our being. And that's what mindfulness is. It's bringing that awareness moment to moment, at every moment, and addressing each individual in that kind of way. So it's a different way of framing mindfulness.
And you took it in a new direction in a lot of ways, trying to see what mindfulness looked like in the brain. We hear a lot about neuroscience and investigating emotions and where they come from nowadays. But when you started out with this, what kind of reaction did you get telling people you wanted to research where the emotions were housed in our brains?
Well, I was treated quite skeptically at the very beginning. Emotions have had a checkered history in the biobehavioral sciences. There was a time when neuroscientists believed that most emotion occurred in subcortical structures. These are structures that sit below the highest centers of our brain and kind of have to do with the most base human qualities. And it then became apparent that this simple-minded view that largely derived from research at the rodent level, mostly with rats and mice, that this wasn't a particularly useful framework for thinking about human emotion, and that human emotion involved much more. And that when we think about human emotion and we think about life's major decisions, think about who you have chosen to be your spouse. Think about very significant purchases like a house that you may have purchased. Those are not decisions that can be easily made without emotion. Emotions inform those decisions in a very useful way, and individuals who have difficulty identifying their emotions and difficulty discerning their emotions actually have problems making those kinds of decisions. And so we then began to search for emotions in other parts of the brain that involve the highest centers of the brain, and sure enough, there is extensive representation of emotion that we find there.
And to reference the Dalai Lama's quote that began us all off, he asks you, while you're looking at anxiety, you're looking at fear, why not apply these tools of neuroscience to positive emotions? You did that. You went and you managed to work with some expert meditators, in this case, Buddhist monks who had clocked, what was it, hundreds of hours of meditation?
Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands in their lifetimes. And you worked with them and you looked at their brain through neuroimaging for the first time, looking at these qualities of mindfulness, of well-being. What did you find?
Well, these were really important initial studies because we reasoned that if we did not find anything that was a clear signal in the brains of these so-called expert meditators, we were unlikely going to find signals in the brains of more novice practitioners. And so this was a very reasonable place to start. And we had the great fortune of having an amazing recruiter who can recruit these participants for us, and that was none other than the Dalai Lama himself. What we did in those early years is we flew people who resided in Asia, typically in India and Nepal, and they came to Madison and spent some period of time in residence in our laboratory, and then we poked and probed them in different ways to learn about what may be different about their brains. And the amazing thing was that very soon into this project, we began to see signals that have never before been seen in a human brain, signals that were very unusual and that clearly indicated that there was something different about these brains. And this was really the beginning of this journey. We were not able to definitively conclude that these signals were produced by meditation because these are individuals who are highly rarefied people. The average number of lifetime hours of practice among these individuals was about 34,000 hours of practice. And so you can go do the arithmetic at home, but 34,000 hours is a huge number. Most people would not make the choice to spend that kind of time doing this sort of thing. And so the skeptics said to us, well, maybe their brains were just different to begin with. While the findings from these practitioners were necessary, they were clearly not sufficient in helping us to discover what may be important in going on, that's going on in the brains of these individuals.
Well, you're hinting at this. Many of us will not meditate for 34,000 hours in our lifetimes. I know you've looked at shorter spans of time. Can short bursts, I don't think burst is a good word for meditation, but short spells of meditation make a noticeable difference in our brains? Can we start to see a bit of that same kind of signal?
It's such an American question. But after
can
all,
we do it
we
fast,
are.
Man?
Right. And the answer is yes. We can see changes in the brain after really short periods of practice, which is quite amazing. We published a study a couple of years ago in complete novices, and we had them go through 2 weeks of training where they were practicing about 30 minutes a day, so it was a total of 7 hours. And we did brain scans, MRI scans, on these participants before and after this 2 week period of practice. And sure enough, we were able to see changes after just this short period of time. So it is the case that really short periods of time can make a difference. And I would say that even less than a half an hour is perfectly acceptable and can produce real change. And When individuals come to me and say, well, they just can't meditate and doing 30 minutes is impossible, start with 2 minutes, really short periods. And then one can gradually build up. And it's sort of like physical exercise. You wouldn't jump into doing a major marathon if you are completely out of shape, but you can start slowly and begin to see if this is something that is producing benefit.
Richard Davidson is a UW-Madison neuroscientist who studies the effects of mindfulness on the brain. We'll hear the rest of that conversation after Look at the News with Kristen Durst. Last week, Veronica Rickert and I talked to Richard Davidson, one of the world's foremost authorities on the brain and mindfulness. We pick up that conversation now with the question, are people basically good?
One of the things I know you're looking at now that's been a little bit more controversial, but there is some evidence starting to pile up, is that maybe people are innately good. And by that I mean maybe they lean a little toward altruism. If they have a choice between the two, they're going to pick the positive. What do you know about where we are in that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Veronica, and I love to talk about this. And it's a burgeoning area of scientific interest. You're quite right that it is more controversial than some of the other topics, largely because the evidence is not yet as robust as we would like. But there's increasing evidence to suggest that if an individual is given a choice between an altruistic and a warm-hearted encounter compared to one that is selfish, competitive, aggressive, the individual will consistently choose the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter. And these biases that I call innate basic goodness can be discerned very early in life. And I can give you an example of that. But, you know, it's when we think about it, people don't sign up for courses to learn how to become more angry or more sad. They do sign up for things where they can learn how to become more happy and improve their well-being. And so there is some kind of face valid evidence that there isn't a natural predisposition for people to increase their negative emotions. The evidence in young infants is particularly interesting. If we show a very young infant, say 6 months of age, a short video clip depicting a warm-hearted, altruistic encounter compared to one that is selfish, the six-month-old infant will consistently prefer the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter. Now, how do we know a six-month-old infant would prefer it? You ask them. And the way we ask a six-month-old infant is one way we could do it is by monitoring very carefully with infrared eye tracking. We can monitor their eye movements. And so we can look to see where they're looking. And they prefer to look at the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter compared to one that is very, very carefully matched on all other characteristics but depicts a selfish and aggressive encounter.
Staying with positive behavior, I know you've been talking about generosity lately as a positive behavior that brings us benefits and maybe reinforces more positive behavior in the future.
Yeah, so generosity is really an interesting one. We've recently written this piece that's part of the UN World Happiness Report that came out in April of 2015. And this is the first year, this is the third year that this report has come out. It's the first year that there's a section on neuroscience in that report, and we wrote that section on the neuroscience of well-being, and we talk about four different constituents of well-being that have been neuroscientifically investigated and validated. And one of those, interestingly, is generosity. The act of generosity activates circuits in the brain very, very powerfully that are associated with positive emotion. Giving, you know, the Dalai Lama has been saying this for years. The most effective strategy for promoting happiness is to be generous to others. And the data, the neuroscientific data, are consistent with that. And there are also psychological data that are consistent with that. There are these crazy studies that social psychologists have done where people come into the lab in the morning and they're given $100 in cash and they're told, go spend this money on whatever you'd like that you have felt guilty about buying for yourself. Here's $100. The only constraint is you must spend every penny on yourselves. Another group that's randomly assigned is given the same $100 and told to spend that money for gifts for others. And they come back in the lab at the end of the day. Guess which group shows a very significant boost in happiness? Of course, it's the group who is purchasing gifts for others. And so there's a lot of evidence to suggest that generosity really does promote well-being.
That's so interesting, because you think you spend so much time trying to hang on to your acquisitions and protect things even for your family, but are you saying we might actually be putting a ding in our own happiness by doing that? That if we would just focus on giving away, we could have measurable increase in well-being and happiness?
Yeah, this is the premise, Veronica, of Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling on Happiness. Dan Gilbert is a psychologist at Harvard, a colleague and a good friend, and wrote this book called Stumbling on Happiness. And that's exactly the premise, that we misconstrue the causes of our own happiness. And the empirical work does clearly suggest that beyond a certain minimal level of material possessions, that anything beyond that really does not contribute in any significant way to our happiness.
Didn't they used to put a price tag on it, though, and money can buy happiness, say up to $50,000 or something like that? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that there are important elements of truth in that. And so beyond some minimal basic level of support, the data, from my perspective, really does not suggest that increased income beyond that is linearly associated with happiness.
Another area I think you've been looking at is epigenetics, they call it. So we've got our genes, and we used to kind of think of it as a blueprint. The genes lead directly to this. It's way more complicated than that. Some genes get activated, some don't. What are you looking at in that area?
Yeah, so that's a great question. What's happening in genomics is kind of parallel to what's happened with neuroplasticity and neuroscience. There's much more dynamic change in these systems than we previously thought was possible. You can think of genes having little volume controls, many genes, and these volume controls regulate the extent to which a gene is turned on or turned off. And it turns out that our emotions, our demeanor, our the qualities of our well-being impact that. And there are specific practices that impact that, specific training. And we published a paper last year showing that one intensive day of meditation, 8 hours among experienced meditators, was sufficient to produce a measurable change in their gene expression. And we had control participants come into the laboratory for a day of leisure. And we saw no change in those individuals who had the same sedentary day. So it appears that the regulation of our genes is under much more dynamic control. And this really has profoundly important impact for our health, because a lot of these genes are affected by practices that can promote well-being are genes involved in, for example, inflammation. And we know that inflammation is at the core of many chronic illnesses.
And I know another area of interest to you particularly is your work with children. So you're looking at how some of these mindfulness practices, cultivating kindness, things like that, can have an impact on the young developing brain. Can you tell us a little bit about where your research is leading you there?
Yeah, so this is really an extension of our work. We call it translational research, where we take the insights that we have gleaned from basic research in the laboratory and bring it out to real-world contexts. And we reason that if we can help young children to promote positive qualities of mind and provide them with simple exercises and skills that can then become lifelong, we could potentially, with modest interventions early on, have multiplicative effects as the children develop. When we first began to think about this, we went to the Dalai Lama and I asked him for advice about what kinds of practices would be most appropriate for young children, and he just looked at me and started laughing hysterically and said, "I've never had children, so I have no idea." So he said, "Please use science to investigate this." So that's what we've been doing, and we've developed a curriculum that we call the Kindness Curriculum, which is a curriculum that right now is focused for preschool children. We have been implementing this in the Madison Metropolitan School District in randomized controlled trials. And the first scientific paper based on this curriculum just came out this year, just a couple of months ago, showing really positive benefit from a 12-week curriculum that teaches children simple practices of mindfulness and kindness.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Richard Davidson, director of the Wiseman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. We spoke to him at an event last week.